What do you do when your codebreakers hand you the exact flight schedule of the man who planned Pearl Harbor? I mean the exact schedule, departure time, arrival time, which airstrips, which aircraft, down to the minute. I'm Tail Dragger on Radio Hangar, and today we're going to talk about one of the most precisely planned interception missions in the history of aerial warfare. April 18, 1943, 18P-38, Lightnings, 435 miles of open ocean. And a man who was always exactly on time. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me tell you about Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. He was the commander of the Imperial Japanese Navy's combined fleet. If you know Pearl Harbor, you know his name. He was the architect of the December 7, 1941 attack, brilliant tactician, educated in the United States. He had studied at Harvard and served as a naval attaché in Washington. He knew America better than most of his colleagues, which is reportedly why he was skeptical about the war from the start. There is a famous line attributed to him, whether apocryphal or not, that attacking America would awaken a sleeping giant. But orders were orders, and Yamamoto delivered. By the spring of 1943, the war in the Pacific had turned. Guadalcanal had fallen to the Americans after a brutal six-month campaign. Yamamoto wanted to boost morale among his forward troops, so he planned an inspection tour of air bases in the Solomon Islands. He was going to personally visit the men, and his staff sent the itinerary by radio. Here is where it gets interesting. The Americans had been cracking Japanese naval codes since before the war. The effort was called MAGIC. The codebreakers at Pearl Harbor, operating out of a facility called Station Hypo, had broken the Japanese JN-25 naval cipher. When Yamamoto's staff transmitted that itinerary, American intelligence intercepted it, decoded it, and had the admiral's full schedule on a desk in Pearl Harbor within hours. The decoded message said Yamamoto would depart Rabaul on the morning of April 18th. He would fly to Balale airstrip near Bougainville in a Mitsubishi G4M bomber, which the Allies called the Betty. The flight would take approximately 1 hour and 45 minutes. He would arrive at 7:45 in the morning, local time. And here was the thing about Isoroku Yamamoto. The man was punctual. Legendarily so, his staff knew it. The Japanese fleet knew it. If the schedule said 7:45, you could bet your life he would be there at 7:45. The Americans now had to make a decision that had nothing to do with aviation. Do you act on this intelligence? If you send fighters to shoot down Yamamoto's plane, the Japanese may figure out their code has been broken, they will change it, and magic. This extraordinary intelligence advantage that had been shaping American strategy across the entire Pacific goes dark. Admiral Chester Nimitz pushed the question up the chain. It reached the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox. Some accounts say it went to President Roosevelt himself. The answer came back, get him. The mission was called Operation Vengeance. Now let's talk about the flying problem, because it is a serious one. Yamamoto's route would take him over the island of Bougainville in the northern Solomons. Henderson Field on Guadalcanal, the nearest American airbase, was roughly 435 miles from the intercept point. 435 miles one way. In 1943, flying 435 miles over open ocean, fighting and then flying 435 miles home was right at the edge of what single-engine fighters could do, and well beyond what most of them actually could do, except the P-38 Lightning. The P-38 was Lockheed's answer to the long-range escort problem. Twin engines, twin tail booms. A central nacelle for the pilot. It could carry external drop tanks under its wings, which extended its range dramatically. Even so, this mission would push the airplane to its limit. The planner was Major John Mitchell, a Mississippi farm boy turned fighter pilot, and the man was meticulous. He worked out the navigation manually, timed legs, speed calculations, drift corrections, no GPS. Obviously, no inertial navigation. A compass, an airspeed indicator, and a clock. He needed to put his formation over a specific patch of sky above a jungle island at a very specific minute, after flying a complicated dogleg route across open ocean. 18 P-38s launched before dawn from Henderson Field. Within minutes, two of them turned back with mechanical problems, drop tank issues that would have left them short of fuel. 16 pressed on. Four of those 16 were designated the killer flight. Their job was to go after Yamamoto's Betty. The other 12 were top cover, assigned to deal with the 6-0 escort fighters that Japanese intelligence said would be with him. The killers went low, the cover element stayed high. Radio silence from the moment they lifted off. Strict, absolute radio silence. They descended to 50 feet above the water and swept out into open ocean south of the Solomons, 50 feet off the water, for hours, in a P-38. If you have ever flown low over open water, you know what turbulence feels like down there over warm ocean. The surface is never flat, the air above it is never smooth, and you are in a fighter with two Allison engines roaring and no horizon worth trusting, and you are navigating by dead reckoning because if you climb any higher, you might show up on Japanese radar. The pilots had been briefed on what to intercept, but most of them had not been told why. They were told to kill a Japanese transport aircraft and its escorts. The full weight of what was on that plane did not come down on most of them until after, at 7:34 in the morning, 16 minutes ahead of their planned arrival. Lieutenant Rex Barber was looking across the water and he saw them, two Betty bombers, low and slow, heading toward Bougainville, above and slightly behind, the silhouettes of six Zeros. The Zeros saw the P-38s at nearly the same moment. What followed was a few minutes of complete chaos. The kill flight dove on the Bettys. The cover flight hauled up to engage the Zeros. Rex Barber went after the lead Betty. A pilot named Tom Lanfear also engaged, claiming later that he shot down one of the Bettys in a near-vertical diving pass. The accounts differ on what Lanfear actually hit, and he and Barber disagreed about it, bitterly and publicly, for the rest of their lives. What is not disputed is this: one Betty was hit. It shed pieces of its left wing. It went down into the jungle short of the airstrip. The second Betty tried to make for the water and was caught and shot into the sea near the coast. Rex Barber took serious hits on his way off the Betty. His P-38 had over 100 holes in it by the time he got back to Guadalcanal. Lieutenant Raymond Hine never came back. We do not know exactly what happened to him. He may have been hit by the Zeros, or he may have gone down from damage or fuel. He was listed as missing in action. He was never found. The rest of the formation made Guadalcanal with fuel gauges in the red. Now here's the part of the story I want you to sit with. A Japanese search party found the wreckage of the first Betty the following day, in heavy jungle, near the coast of Bougainville. They found Admiral Yamamoto. He was in his seat, which had been thrown clear of the burning aircraft. He was in full dress uniform, white gloves, upright, sword at his side. Two bullet wounds, the cause of death was a gunshot wound to the head. He had been dead before the plane hit the trees. The Japanese kept it quiet for weeks. When they finally announced his death, they made him a national martyr, a state funeral, a hero of the empire. The Americans kept quiet for a different reason. The official story, quietly encouraged, was that a coast watcher, one of the civilian Australians and islanders, hiding in the jungle and reporting Japanese movements, had spotted the flight and tipped off the Americans. It was plausible, coast watchers were real and they saved a tremendous number of Allied lives in that campaign. The truth about the code breaking did not become widely known for decades. The controversy over who shot down Yamamoto's plane has never been fully resolved. Rex Barber and Tom Lanfear both claimed the kill. The Air Force eventually split the credit. The argument continued long after both men were gone, and the families carry it still. I will tell you what I think, for whatever a retired captain's opinion is worth. Barber was the one riding the tail of the lead Betty. The geometry of the attack, the damage patterns on the wreck, and the position reports favor his account. But Lanfear was a real fighter pilot, and the chaos of that intercept makes certainty impossible. What you can say with certainty is this: 16 P-38 Lightnings flew 435 miles over open water, arrived within 2 minutes of their planned intercept time with no radio and no navigation aids beyond a compass and a clock, and they killed the man who planned Pearl Harbor. The date was April 18, 1943. Pull up a chair and think about that for a second. April 18, 1942, Jimmy Doolittle's bombers launched off the deck of the Hornet to hit Tokyo. Exactly 1 year later to the day, American aviators intercepted the architect of the attack that had started the whole war. History occasionally has a sense of timing. Major Mitchell's navigation that morning was one of the most remarkable feats of dead reckoning in the history of military aviation. That is not a compliment casually offered. 435 miles, wave top altitude, radio silence, a dogleg course around Japanese radar, and he put 16 airplanes at the right point in the sky within 120 seconds of the planned intercept. Think about that the next time your GPS loses signal and you feel slightly anxious. The mission is sometimes described in modern terms as a surgical strike, which is technically accurate but misses the texture of what those pilots actually experienced. They flew a very long, very dangerous mission in the pre-dawn darkness, at 50 feet above open ocean, in strict silence, with no margin for error. They fought a sharp engagement against Zeros and got the target. And then they flew home, most of them barely making it on fumes. Rex Barber flew his shot up, Lightning, all 435 miles back. Ray Hine did not.
That is always the part that stays with me. The history books record the result.
The mission is a success. And somewhere between Bougainville and Guadalcanal, a P-38 went into the Pacific, and a young man from somewhere in America never came home, and we do not know exactly where or why. That is not a footnote. That is the whole weight of it. Some of the pilots who flew that morning said later that when they finally learned whose plane they had shot down, the significance took time to land. In the air, they had been managing airspeed, fuel, threats, a firing solution. The geopolitical meaning of what happened did not arrive until they were sitting on the ground, still in their flight gear, trying to process what the debrief officer had just told them. That is what combat aviation is, a lot of the time. You are flying the airplane. The history is happening around you, and it does not always feel like history in the moment. Yamamoto was 59 years old when he died. He had been in the Japanese Navy for over 4 decades. He had lost 2 fingers in a naval battle in 1905. He had studied in America, served there, and ended up planning the attack that brought the most powerful industrial nation in the world into the war against the empire he served. Whatever he privately thought about the probable outcome, he flew that schedule. On time, the P-38 Lightning went on to an extraordinary war after this. Richard Bong, America's top scoring ace with 40 confirmed kills, flew every one of them in a Lightning. The type ultimately destroyed more Japanese aircraft than any American fighter in the Pacific. Yamamoto's sword recovered from the jungle with his body is preserved in Japan. The wreck of the Betty sat in the trees on Bougainville for decades, gradually stripped by visitors and the jungle itself. People have walked into that undergrowth, in the heat and the insects and the silence, and stood over the bent aluminum and thought about what happened above them on a Tuesday morning in April 1943. I understand that impulse completely. Carol V. Glines and Burke Davis each wrote thorough accounts of Operation Vengeance, and the wartime records are held at the National Archives if you want to go deep. RadioHangar.com is where you can find us. I'm Tail Dragger. One more thing before you go. Somebody out there hasn't checked their oil in 3 flights. You know who you are. Go check it.